No me engañes.
Sexy.
Listening to WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, WBAI.org, on the web. Charlie Palmieri, La Ernica, takes us up to 11:02, and coming up next, Living for the City with Michael G. Haskins. Welcome to Living for the City. It's a program focusing on telling the stories, our stories, our perspectives of local communities throughout our area and beyond. If you've lived in New York City for any length of time, you know how difficult it is to get the media to report about a subject in depth, tell the truth, or even cover an issue in certain circumstances. We examine those very issues, especially dealing with the power of the real estate lobby, housing and land use, as well as air and water use. We do this truthfully, accurately, and without any conflicts of interests or loyalties. I'm Michael G. Haskins. Julian Jonas is the senior producer for the program, and I welcome you to the show every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Well, a new large-scale development project has been proposed for an area smack within the South Street Seaport Historic District. Most of the proposed towers exceed the 120 square feet zoning limits set for the historic district, including one building at 1,000 square feet. Naturally, there are many concerns about the integrity of the historic district. But wait, there's more. Community members are worried about some significant environmental issues a common complaint we've heard from Living for the City. We've heard this on Living for the City from numerous grassroots organizations in other neighborhoods across the city. With me to discuss all this is Michael Kramer, steering committee member of the Seaport Coalition, and Megan Malvern, co-founder and parent organizer of Children First, which is a member of the coalition. Welcome, Megan, and welcome, Michael. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Michael.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having us.
Oh, great. Michael, let's start with you. Let's talk, give us some details about the South Street Historic District. And in 2015, if I recall, the National Trust for Historic Preservation named South Street Seaport to its list of America's 11 most endangered historic places. Now, that's significant. That's one detail. Give us some others.
Well, this is where New York began. Our little 11 blocks is where all the ships used to come in during the 16th and 17th and 1800s, and that's where Wall Street began, that's where commerce began, that's where the slave trade began mm-hmm. in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Characterized by low-rise buildings, 4 and 5 stories, characterized by their proximity to the water, to the East River, where there used to be all sorts of piers and ports. We're looking at a historic district. It was the first that was created back in 1977. It was later extended to include an area that includes the Pecksniff School that Megan will talk about. And it is in great danger because a developer has taken a parking lot and is proposing to build 4 times as much as they're allowed to build.
Mm-hmm. So, all right, let's flesh this out. What other details are important for our listeners to know? I remember not that long ago, WBAI used to be down in that neck of the woods, if you will. We were on 120 Wall Street, right next, the last building on Wall Street, right next to the East River. In fact, because of Superstorm Sandy, we had to... we had to leave that area because of the water. So tell us, give us more about the historic nature of the area.
Sure. Well, I feel for you because I lived on historic Front Street. Mm. It took me 8.5 months to get back into my,
sure,
my
sure
apartment
did, yeah.
because of the water.
Mm-hmm.
We had 8.5 feet of water.
Mm.
So the relationship between the land and the water is really what makes the seaport so special. And there's a seaport museum that's dedicated to talking about, to telling that story. And it's part of the solution, but it's also been part of the problem. So we're in a situation now where we think that the seaport needs to maintain its uniqueness. And we're fighting a developer / Wall Street tycoon who thinks differently. And now we're literally fighting City Hall, and it's quite a challenge.
Yeah. Now, you successfully defeated, speaking of which, large-scale development plan by the Howard Hughes Corporation over the course of several years, culminating in 2018. This is a company who hasn't been great at public notification, or has it lived up to some of its promises? These developers always make big pronouncements and promises, but they haven't done so. But they're back with a new, even larger project set for a different site. Can you explain that for us?
Sure. Well, billionaire Bill Ackman, you may have heard of him because he was shorting Herbalife for a long time, is behind Howard Hughes. He owns basically almost 30% of the company. Back in 2014, 2015, we stopped a 51-story building that was going to be built on the water's edge. And now he decided to buy a parking lot that's inside the historic district. And he bought it from the Milstein family, another big real estate family in New York. They tried 9 times to come up with something that the Landmarks Commission would allow them to build in the historic district and failed. But Bill Ackman has is fearless, and so he decided he was going to take a shot at it now. And he is, and they proposed a building that was 48 stories high in a district where they're only allowed 12 stories. And yesterday at the Landmarks Preservation Commission, they were told to effectively go back to the drawing board. You know, no action was taken by the Landmarks Commission. They would not approve their application.
That's interesting. Megan, I'm going to come to you in a minute. Megan Malvern, the co-founder and parent organizer of Children First, which is a member of the coalition, and the coalition I'm speaking of is the Seaport Coalition. Michael Kramer is on that steering committee. I'm going to come to you in a minute, Megan, but Michael, just staying with you.
Mr. Haskins?
Sure.
Mr. Haskins, may I just point out one interesting point is you brought up the 2015, that the district was placed on the most endangered.
Mm-hmm.
It was specifically, if you look at the press release from the trust that made that pronouncement, specifically put on there because of Howard Hughes. They are literally listed as the reason why they knew it was going to be a heck of a fight in the Seaport once Howard Hughes got involved there.
Okay, well, we'll come to you in just a moment. Michael, let's finish up here. Where does the historic district fit into this new plan that they've come up with?
Well, they claim that the design of the building will look just like the historic district. And if you can tell me how a 105-foot, so that's about a 10-story building that's basically a block-long wall would fit in with 4- and 5-story buildings, historic buildings from the 1800s. Let's just say politely that it's an architectural design challenge. And then when you throw a 37- and a 38-story building on top of that and say that it will not overwhelm and dominate a whole historic district and reduce the size of the historic district by 10%, then, you know, you start to get past the point of credibility. One of the beauties of being down there is we're so close to the Brooklyn Bridge, and the Brooklyn Bridge is sort of, the overarching iconic feature of the Seaport. And, the way that they have been building on Pier 17, you can't even see the bridge sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's this little neighborhood left that brings New York to the water, that connects us with our maritime past, and they want to just turn it into an entertainment center, a restaurant, and retail, shopping opportunity or experience. And, we're fighting really hard. And we really have the neighborhood with us. We have the community with us. We have the historic preservationist community with us. And we really think that this is a cause that's worth fighting for.
Mm-hmm. Michael Kramer, the steering committee member of the Seaport Coalition. Megan Malvern, also part of this organization and parent organizer of Children First. Now, the Landmarks Preservation Commission, as Michael referred to a moment ago, rejected previous applications 9 times for smaller buildings concerned about size issues like scale, density, and size of impact on the historic district, which is zoned for a height limit of 120 square feet. Now, did I say something in the introduction about the building that was 1,000 proposed? So 1,000.
120 feet.
Yeah.
And it's 925,000 square feet that they want to put on that property.
Mm-hmm. I thought I had. So Megan, how is this even being considered? And talk a little bit more about what happened last night at the Landmark Preservation meeting. And what does all of that mean?
So the meeting yesterday, I have to tell you, our community feels really energized by the decision from the LPC. I mean, the purpose of good government is to protect its most vulnerable. And that's what LPC did yesterday. It put down their foot, and it's protecting this really fragile historic district. But it's more than fragile for because it could be overdeveloped. Literally fragile, and it has been a safe place for my child, for my children, for the past 6 years because they go to school there. And so that parking lot is worth everything to this community, but it is certainly not worth the $180 million that Howard Hughes paid for it.
Mm-hmm. And what does the developer need to obtain from the city? Because I know that's always in there somewhere, from the city or state. And why are air rights in the middle of this plan? Air rights.
If I could, I'd like to back up just a little bit. One of the things they absolutely need is because they, as a volunteer, went into this program called the Brownfield Program, mm-hmm. which is a state-run program to clean up toxic chemicals and pollutants in the site. They need to get the brownfield approved and taken care of. That's one of the steps that they're working through. And then I know there's a myriad of stuff through the ULURP process that Michael is much more familiar with.
But
the brownfield has been handled poorly from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Michael, did you want to touch on what Megan was just referring to?
Sure. So what Megan is talking about is air rights are the envelope that's buildable above a building that are unused. And usually air rights can only be transferred from one adjacent building to another.
Mm-hmm.
There's a line of sight. And what the developer wants to do is they want to transfer what they consider to be air rights over the water to their parking lot three blocks away. And they need all sorts of permissions to do that. So the good news is that they have to go in front of the public, and it has to be a public process to do that. They can't just do a private deal behind mm-hmm. everybody's backs. The bad news is that they're even thinking about doing that because what they're trying to do is they're trying to pile more development rights onto that site so they could build big, where they're not able to use those development sites where they have already built. So it's a way of getting around the zoning.
Mm-hmm. Is there some kind of zoning variance involved here?
Well, there are all sorts of text amendments that might be considered receiving sites, granting sites, things like that. But at the end of the day, it's really just trying to take this lump of air, putting it on top of another site, and then building as high as you can.
Mm. Now, just reorienting the audience that is tuned in to 99.5 FM WBAI, the name of this program is Living for the City. I'm your host, Michael G. Haskins, and my guests today are Michael Kramer, steering committee member of the Seaport Coalition, and Megan Malvern, co-founder and parent organizer of Children First. And we're talking about the South Street Seaport. And many listeners who have been with us for many years, several years, do remember that area of New York City, right down by the East River. WBAI has been there since, what was it, late 1990s. So they're familiar with this area, had been down, of course, this is pre-COVID, down to this station many, many times. Megan, I'd like to ask you, what are these environmental concerns? I hear these from different organizations. What are those concerns that you have, a history of mercury factories in the area and so on? Could you outline those?
Sure. So in 2018, we heard that the lot was purchased and everyone got everyone's attention because it was such a big purchase price. And then not until months later did we hear that they are applying for the brownfield because they knew that the lot was contaminated with lots of, there was a gas station there at one point. So there's likely a petroleum tank under the ground somewhere, all that kind of stuff. So, but we never even heard about it, that it was in the brownfield until I was alerted on the cobblestones. I was PTA president at the time. I'm on the cobblestones there with my kids, and another member of the community board is like, oh, hey, you might want to come listen to this thing tomorrow night. Howard Hughes is presenting about the brownfield toxic cleanup of 250 Water Street. What? First time I'd heard about it. So I go to the meeting, and I say at the meeting, I stand up and I said, our school was never informed. We've never heard about this being even in the process. And the only reason why I know about this today is because I was personally reached out to. That doesn't seem like the proper procedures. And they said, oh, we sent the letters. You guys just must have missed it. Okay, whatever. So I sit down and I listen to the rest of the their plans for the brownfield. And that's where I start to hear all these words. I hear mercury. I hear VOCs. I hear lead. I hear, and that's when I'm like, oh, wait a minute. This is a serious thing. But then they, at the same meeting, said, you've got nothing to worry about. We are so good at cleaning this stuff up. We've hired this engineering team, Langen. They're exceptional. And Langen goes on to tell us that they've done this a million times before. Mm-hmm. I go home, and I'm like, oh, gosh, mercury. Mercury is really bad. I start looking into the mercury stuff. And they also had said that there was a thermometer factory, a thermometer warehouse is what they said on the site. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, wait a minute. That's not regular mercury that you find in the ground. That is concentrated, liquid, elemental mercury.
Very toxic.
That's the stuff that causes neurological problems for children and exceptionally so for pregnant women. Yeah. And I don't know if you've been to a pickup at a preschool elementary lately. There's a lot of pregnant ladies who are there and the teachers too. Mm-hmm. So when we started looking into it, and it turns out one of our moms, one of the people from our group from Children First, goes down to the city planning department and looks through the DOB records and finds there are three, maybe four separate thermometry factory locations that are on that lot. Mm. And actually, they end up finding out that it was the world's largest thermometer manufacturer, and at one point pushed out 500,000 thermometers in a year. Mm. We went back to Hughes and asked them, how have you ever done anything like this before? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. We've cleaned up stuff like this for tons of different times, tons of different places. Even had the nerve to give us locations where they've done similar cleanups. Mm-hmm. I look into it. It's not elemental mercury. It's like a mile away. It is nothing like what they're faced with. And they eventually, in a public meeting, admit it's an entirely unique situation that they have never encountered before.
Wow.
But without the moms doing this work and bringing it to the attention, they wouldn't have done it. And we asked, why didn't you speciate for elemental mercury? You knew there was a thermometer factory there. You know there are children here, the most sensitive receptors possible. Their answer was, we didn't have to.
Well, as you say, Megan Malvern, without the moms, without the organization, and that's what this program in part is about, having groups such as yours, the co-founder of Children First, such as Michael Kramer, the steering committee member of the Seaport Coalition on WBAI's Living for the City at 99.5 FM. We're commercially free and listener sponsored. This is why we can have this expansive conversation. Let me stay with you a moment longer on this, Megan Malvern. Howard Hughes is making several promises, including $50 million for the Seaport Museum. So what's the situation with that museum? Because $50 million, it seems like an awful lot of money.
Goes way beyond my. I've been in this district for 12 years, and it's funny. I lived through Sandy. Before Sandy, I used to take my little boys to their mini mates classes. It was one of the most enjoyable things I have ever done. It was directly playing and inside this Skirmerhone Row, you know, is just magnificent. Mm-hmm. Then, unfortunately, Sandy happened, and the museum hasn't been open since then. Mm-hmm. My kid's 8 years old. He's not. I think he went to it once before the mm-hmm. before it happened.
That's what Sandy.
So I'm sad to say I don't have much of a relationship mm-hmm. with the Seaport Museum, because it's been shuttered mm. for so long. Mm. And I think Michael would have way better information about how important and what its role is in the neighborhood.
Michael?
Well, the developer correctly assumed that everybody loved the Seaport Museum and wanted to bring it back to life. And that's why they waved this magic check in front of the elected officials and said, let us build four times what we're allowed to build, and we'll give something back to the community. And that's not the way that New York should be developed. It's not the way that New York should be planned. We're sort of very, very happy that the Landmarks Preservation Commission, which is really just an amazing group of unpaid commissioners who they sat through 9.5 hours of our testimony mm-hmm. a week ago Tuesday. They are not allowed to look at zoning. They're not allowed to look at community benefits. They're only allowed to look at what impact this will have on the historic district as to whether it's appropriate or not for that historic district. And that's why, you know, they came back with a no action. They would not approve how it uses plan. But unfortunately, money buys elected officials, you might say. And the elected officials who count for us are our local city council member and our borough president, who testified in favor of how it used. Mm. And they testified in favor of how it used. Not in favor of how it used. They testified in favor of the museum.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the way that we should be doing planning in New York.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to certainly stay with this and continue looking at this issue, the South Street Seaport. Michael, they're also promising so-called affordable housing, something the city likes to jump on, really, whether it manifests or not, and whether it's affordable to the people who actually need it. Tell us a little bit about that issue.
Well, I mean, the joke is that it's based on the average median income, and this is not, this is a fairly well-off neighborhood. But they claim that there's really no affordable units in the neighborhood, and it just really depends how you define a neighborhood. We're 5 minutes away on the other side of the Brooklyn Bridge from all of the housing projects of NYCHA, for example. If you walk 5 minutes to the north, if you walk 5 minutes to the west, you're not even close to Tribeca. So it's really just a question of using words and using dangling buzzwords for political cover for their project. Mm-hmm. And 90 units of housing would be helpful,
right.
But they've already said they had already promised 160 units of housing. Then they decided they wanted to make all the other apartments much larger, so now it's only going to be 90 units of affordable housing. And then, of course, the other units of housing will all have 11-foot ceilings, and they're going to have 9.5-foot ceilings, and they're all going to be located at the bottom of the building and in some corner of the building, and they'll all be, on the same floors together. They don't understand anything about affordable housing. They're just trying to win the mayor's support because it's a buzzword.
Right. Well, as we prepare to wrap up our conversation this morning, I just want to throw this out to both of you. We'll start with you, Megan. Many other communities in the city are facing upzones. We focus on that as much as we can here at Living for the City. They're facing upzones or out-of-contact developments which could cause displacement, potentially cause displacement and gentrification. The Seaport Coalition has its own plan. Megan, let's start with you, and then we'll wrap up with Michael. Resilience Park, talk about that.
So Resilience Park is such a shame. I mean, it's part of the scoping document that goes into the development side of what's happening now. So before we're talking about the brownfield thing, but now we're in the development side. So there's a scoping document, and you're meant to have in there what are some alternatives for this site. It's just the way it's imagined. And also in that scoping document, they're supposed to look at the environmental impact. They didn't mention schools once. There's a elderly housing facility across the street, which is also, by the way, low income. They didn't talk about that. They didn't even reach out to the NYCHA houses across the street from this lot. So the scoping document is really, really lackluster. The Seaport Coalition really, really tried to see what the real needs are in this community. The real needs are, we are the low-lying, high-risk flood zone. We don't have one piece of resiliency in our neighborhood at all. Not even like a berm, not even a cement thing between here and the water, right, for our district, for this specific area. Also, we have no outside play space. There is no active space. We are the most underserved community as far as outside public access space to parks.
Interesting.
Go to the other side, go to the west side of the city, mm-hmm. there's tons of parks, mm-hmm. but we have nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so we came up with this idea that let's build in some resiliency underneath with these holding tanks that could really help absorb some of the water during the next flooding event. And then on the top, let's put in a park for this community. This is a growing, young neighborhood, and there's no place to go. So that's one of the ideas, and would also, in the middle there, would be this tow pound that the city and the state are desperate to locate.
Mm-hmm.
Someplace
mm-hmm.
in Manhattan is right. the idea. And this seems, it hit all those buttons. It had all those ideas going for it, and it was really, really maligned. And it's an idea. We were saying this is something to explore.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody had the nerve to say, last time I checked, a tow pound didn't do anything for a community. I'm like, okay, but what about the resiliency? What about the park? What about saving the city money because they were going to face fines for not relocating the tow pound? So it's a really smart idea. Is it plausible? We need people to help us work it out.
Work it out.
Michael knows more about how they're going to look at the trying to get some money together
mm-hmm.
for more affordable housing and to make it a little bit more controllable for the district.
Michael Kramer, any final comments on Resilience Park? Anything you want to add to that?
We're not against development. If they were developing according to the rules, we would understand that. Because they're not developing according to the rules, we've created alternatives. Resiliency Park would be to take it away from them and give it for all these different public purposes. No action would mean build something beautiful like we have on Historic Front Street, 4- and 5-story buildings that lots of people want to live in. Something in between is, you know, coming up with a real plan for the financial survival of the South Street Seaport Museum. You know, Santa Claus really isn't coming this year, and we really doubt if Howard Hughes would ever, you know, write the check, and even if they wrote it, whether they would sign it. And then finally, you know, we have lots of ideas about affordable housing downtown, converting hotels into affordable units, converting offices into affordable units. You know, we have a lot of existing buildings that are going begging because of the pandemic, which would allow us to create affordable housing downtown. And there's even a site at the World Trade Center, 5 World Trade Center, that at one point they were proposing to be 100% affordable housing. So we're not against making our community even more diverse than it is, but we are against a developer coming in and telling us what to do.
Both of you have provided our listenership with a great deal of information, probably information they were unaware of about the South Street Seaport and the historic nature of it. May not even have known that it is an historic site. Michael Kramer, steering committee member of the Seaport Coalition. What can listeners do, and give us some contact information? Are there any petitions that need to be signed or that you'd
sure.
like to have people get involved with?
Our website link is seaportcoalition.com. Our petition is at change.org/seaport. And between those two, and we also have a Facebook page, a couple of Facebook pages. There's the Children First NYC Facebook page. There's the Save Our Seaport Facebook page. And there's the Seaport Coalition Facebook page. So we invite you to use social media.
Oh, I'm coming to you. I'm coming to you. Megan, I'm coming to you, please.
Sorry.
We very much encourage you to use social media to stay in touch with us. And we have signed up over 60 coalition partners now who are really concerned that a bad precedent here would affect all the other historic districts.
Thank
you, Michael, for the opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. And Megan Malvern, co-founder and parent organizer of Children First. Go ahead.
Sorry, I just wanted to, we're totally aligned. I mean, the coalition, I can't tell you the beautiful and amazing people I have met through this community grassroots. It's astounding. I love all these cranky New Yorkers. but what I wanted to say is there's also a GoFundMe. We're going to need lawyers. Mm. We're going to need so much help. We're going to need so much support. And I feel like we've really, with the LTC decision, it really has ignited us. But if you go to GoFundMe and you just search Seaport Towers, you'll see us there. And I just, to your point, through the Brownfield program, we got families to send in more letters than the entire Brownfield program from the state has ever seen. They were inundated by concerned families and parents who really just wanted to find out how we can get the best, safest remediation for our kids. And we still don't have that data. Mm. They haven't turned it in since the summer, even despite a FOIL and despite constant requests from Community Board 1, too. So much of this is just snowballing. And I know that if we can just keep up the pressure and lean on some of the right people, that we'll get the best results.
Well,
we're organized.
Well, you can depend upon Living for the City on WBAI to keep pushing the word out. Thank you so much, Megan Malvern. I really appreciate you being here. And Michael Kramer. Thank you both.
Thank you.
I know. For sure. I've seen it all before. What goes around is coming around again.
Michael Kramer, steering committee member of the Seaport Coalition, and Megan Malvern, co-founder and parent organizer, Children First, and a member of the coalition. Brand new song. Been down this road before. Clifton Anderson.
I've I've seen it all before. What goes around is coming around again. History repeats itself, and then I know for sure it's time to close the door. And if not now, then who knows where or when? I know.
Clifton Anderson, been down this road before, haven't we? Yes, we have. We've been down this road before. Brand new from Clifton Anderson, was a guest. Clifton Anderson on trombone was a guest in studio a few years back. Speaking of 120 Wall Street back then, this is listener-sponsored WBAI at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. I'm Michael G. Haskins, the host of the program, and we have some other issues that we must deal with before we run out of time. The news will be coming up at 11:55, but we have to take a look at our Sankofa moment in time. Looking back in history to see where we've come from to help us understand how we come to exist in this current moment and help us chart a course for the future. On this day in peace and social justice history, January 13th, 1874, the Depression of 1873 to 1877 left 3 million people unemployed. The Depression began when railroad owner Jay Cook was found to have issued millions of dollars of worthless stock. Investors panicked and banks closed. The unbalanced, overextended new economy collapsed. In the winter of 1873, 900 people starved to death, and 3,000 deserted their infants on doorsteps. A public meeting was called in New York City's Tompkins Square Park to lobby for public works projects to provide jobs. The city's unemployment rate was approaching 25% at the time. The night before, the city secretly voided the permit for the gathering. The next morning, mounted police charged into the crowd of 10,000, indiscriminately clubbing adults and children, leaving hundreds of casualties. Police Commissioner Abram Duryea commented, quote, "It was the most glorious sight I have ever seen," unquote. The Tompkins Square event was part of a wave of parades of the unemployed and bred riots across the nation. In Chicago, 20,000 people marched, even under police attack. Workers in New York, Omaha, and Cincinnati refused to disperse. In 1958, on this day, Linus Pauling presented the Scientist Test Ban Petition to the United Nations, signed by over 11,000 scientists, including 36 Nobel laureates from 49 countries. It called for an end to nuclear weapons testing for its detrimental health, especially genetic and ecological effects, among other reasons. In reaction to his efforts, Pauling was forced to resign as chairman of the Division of Chemistry and Chemical Engineering at Caltech, California Institute of Technology, after having served in that role for 22 years. Talk about cancel culture. That was in 1958. January 13th, in 1962, 150 members of the Scottish Committee of 100, an anti-nuclear group, began a sit-down protest at the U.S. consulate in Glasgow, Scotland. And finally, on this day in peace and social justice history, January 13th, 1993, a vigil was held opposing the arrival of a ship bringing nearly 2 metric tons of plutonium for a pilot fuel reprocessing plant in Tokai, Japan. The specially constructed ship, the Akatsuki Maru, had carried it 15,500 miles from Cherbourg, France. Many objected to the maritime transport of the highly radioactive material due to the risk of sinking, hijacking, and the resultant risk of further nuclear proliferation. The original plan called for air transport over the United States. And that wraps up our first installment of our Sankofa moment in time, this day in peace and social justice history, over this commercial-free radio station, WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Let's see if we can scare up Rick Smith's labor history in two.
This is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1968. That was the day Johnny Cash performed at Folsom Prison. The Man in Black had played numerous free prison concerts before. Country music legend Merle Haggard remembered seeing him perform at San Quentin a decade earlier. Columbia Records recorded the two concerts at Folsom for release. It was these recordings that many credit with revitalizing the career of Johnny Cash. His daughter Roseanne believes the 1968 appearance signified her father's own personal liberation, saying, quote, "That was the moment he came into the light, when he embodied who he really was." Performing with the Tennessee Three, June Carter, Carl Perkins, and the Statler Brothers, Cash hit the charts with Folsom Prison Blues, which sold more than 3 million copies at the time. He also took the opportunity to advocate for prison reform and prisoners' rights, providing testimony on the subject in the early 1970s. His brother told the BBC in an interview, quote, "He identified with the prisoners because many of them had served their sentences and had been rehabilitated in some cases, but were still kept there for the rest of their lives. He felt a great empathy for those people." Cash might not have actually shot a man in Reno, but he always sided with the underdog. His songs highlighted the working man's life, from the sharecroppers, coal miners, and auto workers to railroaders, truckers, and prison chain gangs. Cash always gave an unromanticized view of hard living and hard labor, as well as interracial and class solidarity.
"I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend. And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison."
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
This is Living for the City, and I'm Michael G. Haskins. There has been quite a bit of hand-wringing over the past week from politicians, major media folk, exclaiming, "What? This is not who we are as Americans." what happened on the 6th of January last week. This is not America. Excuse me. This is exactly who we are as an American society. What we have done for over 100 years around the globe. We have done the kind of behavior that we saw last week. Exactly. You can point to each individual area of the world, whether it is Vietnam, South or North Korea, whether it is Chile, whether it's in the so-called Middle East, all over the globe. This, what you saw last week, in part, is what this country is about. Now, I have a short amount of time, but I just want to share a little something with you. And I'm reluctant, actually, to do this because I've done this before so many times. 30 years ago, I, with some wonderful producers at the time, produced this piece called Lynching an American Tradition. And the name is perfect because that's what this is. It is an American tradition. And I'm hearing people talk about this and raising the specter of lynching again. We don't know, and many do not know, the history of lynching in this country. I've been saying this for over 10 years now. Unless and until we as a society are committed to having an ongoing discussion, a daily discussion, not a one-off, not something that we do over and have a beer afterwards, but I mean an ongoing discussion about race in this country, we will not overcome what we're facing right now. Can we do it? I don't know. I really don't know. But we have to beware. And that's what this Sankofa moment has always been about, looking back to see where we've come from. I'm going to have Professor Eric Foner, professor of history at Columbia University. I believe he's an emeritus professor who was instrumental in the production Lynching an American Tradition. Share just a piece of the history of this country.
America's Unfinished Revolution.
Reconstruction was probably the first period of something resembling true political democracy in this country, including both blacks and whites. New governments were established in the South. Black men held office, exercised the right to vote. And it was only a fairly brief period, but it instituted many important progressive changes in Southern life.
The hope of a better life after years of slavery were smashed as Reconstruction came to a gradual end with the agreement now called the Hayes-Tilden Compromise of 1877. Dr. Eric Foner.
In 1876, the Reconstruction governments had already been overthrown generally by violence in most of the southern states. There still remained three southern states, Florida, Louisiana and South Carolina, in which Republican governments with black participation were still functioning. In the disputed presidential election of 1876, when both Hayes, the Republican, and Tilden, the Democrat, claimed to have won the election, the votes of those three states were sort of the pivotal balance. And eventually, to make a long story short, a deal was worked out between the two major parties whereby the Republicans would win the White House, Hayes would become president, as he did, In exchange for which the last federal troops were removed from participation in Southern affairs.
Dr. Eric Foner, Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution. That's part of Lynching an American Tradition. If you are interested in that, send me an email. That's the best way now, since I didn't tell the call center about this. Send me an email. It's a $50 contribution to WBAI, mghaskins@wbai.org. Our newscast is next, and the Gary Null Show follows at 12 noon. Stay tuned.
From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are the headlines. The House will vote today to impeach Trump for his role in the mob attack at the Capitol 1 week ago. The House is currently debating the impeachment resolution that states, quote, President Trump gravely endangered the security of the United States and its institutions of government. He threatened the integrity of the democratic system, interfered with the peaceful transmission of power, and imperiled a co-equal branch of government. He thereby betrayed his trust as president to the manifest injury of the people of the United States, unquote. The House Judiciary Committee released a report last night that lay out the events of the siege at the Capitol. It argues that the president posed an imminent threat and that his continued presence in office is a clear and present danger to the United States. It concludes the facts establish that he is unfit to remain in office a single day longer. A big question is how many Republicans will vote to impeach Trump. Several House Republicans have signaled that they will support the effort, which will give it a greater chance of succeeding. Liz Cheney, the House Republican Conference Chair, is one of at least five House Republicans who have said they will vote to impeach Trump. The others are John Katko of New York, Fred Upton of Michigan, Jamie Herrera Butler of Washington, and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois. Others are expected to join as well. Once the House votes to impeach, the articles and evidence will be sent to the Senate, where a trial would be held, and there would be final votes to convict or acquit Trump. Under the current schedule, the Senate is not set to resume full sessions until January 19, the day before Biden's inauguration. Some Democrats suggested Pelosi might wait to send the articles and allow Biden to begin his term without impeachment hanging over him, but many other Democrats have urged Pelosi to move immediately. It is unlikely for now that enough Republicans would vote to convict Trump, since two-thirds of the Senate is needed. Yet some Republicans have told Trump to resign, including Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey and Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski. Senator Ben Sasse has said he would take a look at what the White House approves, but stopped short of committing to support it. And it's being reported that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has been telling associates that Trump probably committed impeachable offenses, and that he believes that impeaching Trump will make it easier to get rid of the president and Trumpism from the Republican Party. But it's not clear if he will vote to convict. Democrats say they have to move forward even if the Senate doesn't convict. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders tweeted on Friday that it must be made clear that no president now or in the future can lead an insurrection against the U.S. government. The backlash against Trump for his role in the riot last week extends beyond Congress. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio announced this morning that the city is severing all contracts with the Trump Organization. The New York Times reports the New York contracts are for two ice skating rinks, the Central Park Carousel, and the city-owned Trump Golf Links at Ferry Point. Yesterday, we learned Deutsche Bank will no longer do business with Trump, a move that will cut him off from a major source of loans that once helped him fund his golf courses and hotels. After a series of bankruptcies in the 1990s, it was the only bank willing to give Trump money. The Trump Organization owes the bank about $340 million in outstanding loans. Washington, D.C. Attorney General Carl Racine said Monday he is looking at charging Trump and others who spoke at the rally preceding the deadly riots at Capitol Hill under the D.C. Code of Inciting Violence. Speaking to reporters yesterday, Trump called his inflammatory language at the rally totally appropriate. He said,